Last week with Terry Kellogg, we went through a process of healing. We began the program, the first of three programs in this series on the family, of talking about healing and coming back from the kinds of things that have happened to us, probably all of us to some degree on a scale of 1 to 100. Everybody is somewhere on that scale. Now, obviously, people from incest families, people who've been severely beaten as children, violently beaten, people who've been severely neglected will be impacted by that abuse in a way and degree that others of us will not. But I don't want to ever minimize even mild abuse, that it's abuse. Abuse is abuse. I want to say again tonight that as you understand this family systems notion, that it is a notion of feedback, interdependency, circularity. It is not a model of cause and effect. And what that means, it is not a model of blame. This is not a model that says, Daddy was an alcoholic, Daddy's to blame. It's saying the whole family system was sick. Mother was already codependent when she married Daddy. Mother was already codependent when she married workaholic father. The children are the ones that suffer. The children are innocent. And as they enter into these, of course, mom and daddy came from families where they were innocent. So we're not blaming anybody. We're talking about the sins of the fathers that are visited on the children to the third and the fourth generation. And, you know, if you want to take it back somewhere, take it back to Adam and Eve. But the point is that there's disruption and dysfunction, and people are not living up to their potential. We're not becoming the persons we were meant to be. There is only one sorrow, the sorrow of not being a saint. That is, not being the one you were intended to be. To have lived this one and only life and to never know who you really are is the greatest sorrow of all. It is the greatest sorrow. Now, I've been talking about that as the crisis in the family. We've been talking about the delusion and the denial and how we continue the delusion and the denial. We continue it in our families. We refuse to talk about it, which is the old sick rule, don't talk about it. We refuse to express the emotional pain that we have about it or talk about it. And so people go on living with these secrets, with these repressions. Somebody has said that all illness is about unforgiveness. And what unforgiveness is about is resentment. That is, what resentment is about is unfinished business. What a resentment is from a French word, ressentir, that means to refeel over and over again. When you repress the anger, when you repress the pain into the unconscious, it just circulates over and over and over again. So until we get to forgiveness, you cannot get finished with the past. You cannot get complete. You cannot be in a place where you found your lost child so that you can go on and find the deeper self, find the unique self that you really are. That one and only self that we could go back 5 million years and never find anyone like you. The self that we could go forward 5 million years and never find anyone like you. That's the self we're talking about, and that's the tragedy. So what we showed you last week, when I talked to you about 12-step programs and how people need these programs desperately, and the denial about it, I don't need help, and then the family systems just continue to go on from generation to generation. Next week especially, I'll talk about the collective problem. Already, I'm experiencing people, you know, who, oh, he's talking about families and he's talking about these sacred traditions. And that's exactly what the sickness is, that will continue to keep it where it is. We will not look at it, and then generations after generations will suffer because of that. So Last week, we really talked about the process of forgiveness. Now, the process of the forgiveness is a process that has to begin with anger or hurt, because what is there to forgive if you're not angry and hurt? If you're not angry and hurt about something, then you don't need to go through forgiveness. That's why to deny the anger and the hurt is to deny the forgiveness process. See, I've seen people over and over again say, "I forgive you." Or, "Don't worry, I forgive you." They don't forgive you because they haven't done the work that you have to do to get to forgiveness. And what you have to do to get to forgiveness is get into the feelings. See, ultimately, forgiveness is about mourning. Blessed are they that mourn. It's about grief. The healing feeling is sadness. The healing feeling is sadness. Because sadness completes the past. If you ever grieved for anybody, you ever lost somebody you loved, you go through grieving and then you're born again. It completes the past. So I quoted, "The moving finger writes, and having writ moves on, nor all thy piety nor wit can lure it back to cancel half a line, nor all thy tears wash out a word of it." That is, it's over and done with. Your father did abandon you. My father abandoned me. He was never there for me. I need to heal that wound and quit looking for fathers. Quit looking for substitutes for that. And to the degree that I have done the grieving for that, the wound, it's a wound there, but it's healed. And my belief is that that's what has to happen. Now, there are lots of other approaches to healing other than the one Terry Kellogg described to you last week. And in many ways, some of you may not have to go through that strenuous a kind of healing, but in some sense, everybody's got to go through what I call disenchantment. Or disillusionment. In the Kashinas, you've seen those Kashina dolls? The Hopi Indians use the Kashina dolls. Well, those dolls are the remnants of a puberty rite. In the Kashina tribes, they would put these masks on and come, the children at puberty would be taken into the centers, and these gods would come and dance and tell them stories and scare them and tell them secrets. And the finale of this puberty rite would be to take them into a kiva or a hut. And they were then told that the gods are coming into the hut. And when the gods came into the hut, a big surprise was in store for the children, because when they took the masks off, guess who was there? Mama, daddy, somebody in the tribe. And that's what I call the demythologizing process. Because every child believes that their parents are gods. A lot of my work has been developing religious education programs where we know that children deicize their parents. See, that means that they can only hurt you deliberately, like all gods. Gods? How could gods hurt you because they had mortgages to pay? How could gods hurt you because they had a bad sex life? How could gods hurt you because husband was an alcoholic or wife was a hypochondriac or whatever? See, gods for a child, mom and daddy can only hurt you deliberately. So in the healing process, as you get the anger out, as you get the pain out, then comes the sadness. And then comes the demythologizing. Then comes the realization that they were people just like us when they take the masks off. And we understand that they're not gods and that they suffered just like we did. I'll never forget weeping for probably 2 hours with my brother. One day, years later, when my father told us about the death of his own father and how his father basically had abandoned him, that he died, and my father read about it in a newspaper here. And when he went to the funeral in Dallas, they told him it would be better for him not to be there, that it was uncomfortable. And I'm telling you, when I heard that, my dad was telling us that not, he was not trying to get us to cry or give him sympathy, but it was a moment, a great moment of healing, when I saw him as human, and I saw him as frail, and I saw him as you know, wounded and incapable of loving me out of the kind of things that had happened to him. Now, until you get the anger out, though, don't do what I just said, because that's the denial. Oh, they were just human, they did the best they could, and then you don't get clear of the past. You still are stuck with those emotions. Remember those energies that when you repress them, you tighten muscles, and that's how they go into your body. See, we have all kinds of emotional complications in illness, like somebody who's scared stiff, cold feet, a broken heart, a pain in the neck and other places, a headache. That person gives me a headache. So you got to get the feelings out of your body. Now, once we get the feelings out, then you can find that lost child, this little child that we talked about from the very first program, this private self that got locked in the closet a long time ago because she had to adapt to fit the needs of the system, to whatever her role was, surrogate spouse, little parent, lost child, hero, super responsible one, mascot, comedian, funny one, one who's going to take care of the parents' pain, scapegoat, carry the family's pain, whatever. By the way, tonight again, I wished you would write questions out if you have them, and at a certain point, we'll ask you to pass them over, and we can pass them to the front. But anyway, this lost child. Now, once we found the lost child, it's just the beginning of the process. And you see, remember, I've been saying over and over again that this is a responsibility process, not a blame process. That once I discover what happened to me, then I am responsible for my life. I am responsible to go get the therapy. I am responsible to grow and to overcome my laziness and my entropy. I am responsible to quit basking in my attachment to my suffering. Because look, there is a great attachment to the suffering. There is a great attachment in terms of becoming a responsible person. I mean, it's kind of awesome. I remember when I used to I made all A's a couple of times, and the burden of that was that, man, if you make a B, what are they going to say? What happened to you? You made a B. See, so if you decide that you're really going to be responsible and a self-actualized human being, look, here are basic needs. Remember in the second program when we talked about healthy families, we have a need for self-value, for security, for strokes, for belonging, for love, to be part of a group. By the way, we have a need to be a part of a group. Remember I said last week, and Terry said last week, that the great thing about the 12-step groups is that you're overcoming shame when you go to a group. Remember I told you that I was addicted to my shame? That is, I wouldn't show anybody anything about me, my vulnerability. So you see, a shame-based person believes that you're not worthy of letting others help you. If you're shame-based, you believe that you don't have the right to depend on others. See, that's why I made shame really the soul murder in the deepest part of the illness. Because you see, shame is, once you're shamed, you believe you don't have a right to get your dependency needs met. And what I'm going to tell you next week, and just allude to it tonight, is you can't hope. You can't have any hope if I can't join with you. Hope is always mutual. You can't really hope alone. Not as part of the human family. You can't really hope alone. And you can't really have a relationship with God alone, although we all try to do that. We go off in the cellar somewhere and don't realize that all of the biblical witnesses to community and to the healing community. So what I want to talk to you about tonight is that self-value, security, belonging and love, stimulation, challenge, excitement, structure. Those are the deficiency needs. Those are the minimum needs you need to have a healthy, functioning ego. But in order to be self-actualized, You have greater needs. You have being needs. And not until you find the lost self can you even begin this journey of what I say, leaving home, becoming disillusioned, and finding your true self. See, we talked last week about finding the lost self. Now I'm going to talk about finding the true self. Here's what the tragedy really is. That until we've released that pain from childhood, until we've worked through the past, and for some that may be workshops, therapy, for others it may not be. It may be going through a process of forgiveness, of getting to the anger, getting it out and forgiving. It may be that some people can work this out intellectually. I've not seen too many do it, but I'm not going to disallow that possibility. In other words, if you don't do the feeling work, I believe that most people are going to have to do the feeling work. But once I'm there then, that is, I've found the lost self, I'm beginning to get in touch with my feelings again, now's the possibility of self-actualization and spiritualization. See, Abraham Maslow, the great psychologist, said that to become spiritual is part of human nature. That's biologically grounded, Maslow felt. That the need for meaning, the need for truth, the need for beauty, the need for truth, the need for order, the need for completion, the need for perfection were part of the potentialities of human nature. In his book, The Farther Reaches of Human Nature, Abraham Maslow studied self-actualizing people. The greatest people that we've known. At the outbreak of the Second World War, he said, I'm going to go study the greatest specimens, not the antics of captive and desperate rats and neurotic people. Let's study the greatest specimens. Let's see what plateau experience is and full self-actualization is. Let's see what is possible in terms of being human. And what Maslow found is that we need spiritualization. I want to read you a couple of things that he said, that we need to, the spiritual life is part of the human essence. It is a defining characteristic of human nature without which human nature is not full human nature. Erik Erikson, the man that I used as my great mentor in the other PBS series that I did called The Eight Stages of Man, he writes, religion elaborates, spirituality elaborates on what feels profoundly true even though it's not demonstrable. It translates into some kind of symbols and images, significant words, and codes the exceeding darkness which surrounds man's existence and the light which pervades it beyond all desert or comprehension. Now these are psychologists talking. These are psychologists who have spent their life studying human beings and human needs. Now, what Maslow has told us is that you can't get to these higher spiritual needs if your lower needs are not met. That the need in the system that will dominantly motivate you is the unmet need. So if you're alone and you still have rage and resentment and you've never worked that through, you can't jump into higher consciousness. You can't jump into spirituality. You've got to get the socio-cultural ego working, coping. And that's what I told you last week about I went through 10 of the 12 steps. I went through 10 of the 12 steps of 12-step programs. Now, there are a lot of other therapies other than 12-step programs. 12-step programs are free, and they're the most powerful things we know about in terms of healing addiction. So now we have Alcoholics Anonymous, we have Al-Anon, we have Alateen, we have the adult children of alcoholics, we have the children of alcoholics, we have Narcotics Anonymous, we have Cocaine Anonymous, we have Emotions Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, Families Anonymous, Overeaters Anonymous. There are all those 12-step programs available to people. If any of you are listening to this program, realize that those programs are available to you. That when you walk in there and you're willing to deal with your addiction to your shame and be vulnerable like the rest of us, you have a chance. Because it's not until you give up the denials that you can get healed. We are as sick as our secrets. We are as sick as our secrets. And the degree to which you keep the delusion, see, I remember I said this crisis in the family is a crisis of truth. The truth that'll make you free, tell the truth at any cost. Telling the truth at any cost, which means telling your feelings, that's the truth that'll make you free. Now, I just want to, I talked about these basic powers that we have. We have all these powers. And what gets wounded in any abuse? If you're emotionally abused, it isn't just the emotional abuse. It's the core of you. Any abuse that I've talked about so far is also spiritual abuse, because the very core of you is wounded. Any one of these powers that are denied you wounds the whole of you. And you see, spirituality is the totality of me. Wholeness is what holiness is. My wholeness, as a matter of fact, it's real interesting. The word the Jewish people use, the atonement, if you hyphenate that word, it's the at-one-ment, at-one-ment. The word the Christians use, which is salvation, is salus in Latin, which means wholeness. So we're talking about wholeness, that spirituality is wholeness. So what I want you to see is that at birth, we're pure unconscious. That is, we don't know that we're the, I'm going to say, the image of God. That's my position as a theologian. Others may call it the higher self or the higher consciousness. That's okay with me. I call it the God self or the Christ self, the pure unconscious. Then the first five developmental stages, especially those of you who watched the other series I did, but say through puberty, the end of puberty, that ego consciousness develops. Now, what is ego? That's the small part of consciousness where I focus on one of you right now. Let's say I was dealing with one of you, talking to one of you. My ego is the part of consciousness that narrows and is limited. Okay? And what ego's about is those survival needs. Enough food, clothing, shelter, enough sex, enough security, roof over my head, shelter, enough belonging, enough love, enough structure. Until I have that sociocultural ego mended, as it were, you can't really move into this larger circle. That's my belief. Now, there's some that will argue with that. They say the way to get to the larger circle is just go directly to God. That has not been my experience. And what my experience has been with people who go directly to God, like I'll see people come in 12-step program, they're addicts, they're too much sober, and they go right into the most rigid religious community. And what I believe they do is they just become codependent. They don't have their feelings, needs, or wants anymore. They give them to the religious community. And I'm not saying that people in religious communities who've totally given themselves are codependent, but a lot of the people that I work with are codependent. They have given up their reality for the religious structure that they're in. See, I don't think God ever intended people to give up their reality. Why would he make you anyway? Why would he give you a reality? Why would he give you or she give you a reality if you are just not to have it? You're just this little robot who never does anything. God does it. And people will talk to me like that. They'll say, I didn't do this morning. God did it. See, I just don't believe that. It's like the old farmer that had the field that was all messed up and he plowed it. And somebody said, boy, you and God did a great job on that field. And he said, yeah, you should have seen it when God had it alone. So the point is that, I'm a Christian theologian. It's incarnational. It's God and man. It's both and. But I do everything I can. And so finally, in the last half of life, we move into love, wisdom, and caring. Some have called this the paraconscious mind or the higher consciousness. I call it the God consciousness. Now, that higher consciousness then is the spiritual core of the whole self, if you can see this chart. That if you look at this chart, here are the emotional powers, here are the perceptual powers, your senses, you see here, your internal senses, memory and imagination. Here is your volitional power, the power of willpower. Here is your social power, the power to relate and have relationships and to be a part of the world. what Adler called Gemeinschaftsgefühl, the ability to be part social interest, to be in the world and part of it, the mental powers, the power to know, the power to interpret, the power to imagine, the power to plan, the emotional powers, the power to feel angry, the power to feel sad, the power to feel guilt, the power to feel all the feelings. And then in the center of us is this spiritual core. And that if any of those are wounded, the center is wounded. And if you can see that the lines are dotted lines, meaning that it's always all going on together. But what I want you to see in terms of health for the family is that there is an ultimate place that we human beings are moving if we're moving to our fulfillment. Remember in the very first program I said, what I do is me, for that I came. See, who am I? Who am I? And what is the difference that makes the difference? What will it matter after all, whether I lived or died? Who is this unrepeatable person called John? And that's the difference that makes the difference. That's what identity is. And what I want you to know, that's much more than your sociocultural self. That's who they said you were. That's not who you are. Because in order to get to this deep center, you cannot get there from the outside. You can only get there from the inside. It's the going inward. I want to read you something beautiful here by James Michener. He said, this is the journey that men make to find themselves. If they fail in this, it doesn't much matter what else they find. Money, position, fame, many loves, revenge are all of little consequence. And when the tickets are collected at the end of the ride, they are tossed into a bin marked failure. But if a man happens to find himself, if he knows what he can depend upon to do, the limits of his courage, the position from which he will no longer retreat, his boundaries, the degree to which he can surrender his inner life to some woman or vice versa with a woman, the secret reservoirs of his determination, the extent of his dedication, the depth of his feeling for beauty, for honesty, then he has found a mansion which he can inhabit with dignity all the days of his life. See, I just think that's beautiful, and I think that's what it's about. And that ultimately the tragedy, you see, Leon Blois, the tragedy of not being that, that's the greatest tragedy of all life. Now, the interesting thing is that if we don't have the soil and the families to allow us to develop sort of that first stage, that strong ego. See, it's not a weak ego. We want a strong ego so you can cope and get your survival needs met, so you're not dependent on everybody, that you take care of yourself. Remember, the goal of life is to move from environmental support to self-support, that when you're self-supporting, you're no longer dependent in that very bad sense of addictions. So what we look at then is the possibility of going deeper within ourselves. In that deep, deep process, you find something that you can never know from the outside. And that's really what I want you to hear. There is no knowing. There is no opinions on the outside that can tell you about this inner self. This is what the mystics and the philosophers and the sages and the holy men talk about as meditation. They talk about as prayer. And let me tell you something real personal about this. When I left the seminary, I was 30 years old. I was a drinking alcoholic. I was in severe trouble. I basically felt I had no faith at all. I didn't believe in anything. I had seen a lot of human politics, a lot of ego, a lot of human ego, and I was a very sick person. I was a very diseased person. I went and found myself, you know, after I was laying on a stretcher in a state hospital, December the 11th, 1965. And it was in that moment of collapse and crisis that I decided to live. And I decided to live for myself. And I decided to go back to a 12-step group. And I decided to start all over. because everything up to them, obviously for me, hadn't worked. And as I started over, I found these 12 steps. Now, last week I did 10 of them with you, but the 11th step says we sought through prayer and meditation to increase our conscious contact with our higher power. Now, what I want people to hear is that that is the greatest healing therapy that we have ever known. Bar none, the priest and the clergyman and the rabbis and the psychiatrists all failed with alcoholism. They all failed with those. What worked was one drunk turning to another one and saying, let's help each other, let's overcome our shame and show each other just the way we are. And they found this thing that had started with a Presbyterian minister named Frank Buckner, these six steps, called the Oxford Movement. And they formed a program called the 12 Steps. And those two guys literally transformed the lives of hundreds and hundreds of millions of people. All over the world now, there are 12-step groups. And I want you to hear that the ultimate healing is spiritual. And there is no ifs, ands, or buts about that. You can be behavioral scientist and have all your data and all that stuff, but I'm telling you that this is what works and this is what we know works. That ultimately people cannot be happy unless they have found a relationship with that higher power, that something greater than themselves, that spiritual core, which is finally what will give you that total wholeness about your life. Now, I believe that because it happened to me. Because I went into a place where I was accepted unconditionally, and I saw love in a way I had never seen it anywhere in all those years in the seminary. I had never found anything like this. And I'm not putting down the people that were in my seminary. I haven't found it in a lot of other churches either. What I found it in is that my church was this healing community that for me. Now, I'm not saying this for anyone else, but this is not my bias. This is my conviction that has that centrality of what Christ, Jesus Christ, means to me. That is non-judgment, forgiveness, acceptance, looking at the log in your own eye rather than the speck in your brother's, getting out of that us and them and those sick ones over there and those sinners and the moral minority. And this divisiveness that has nothing to do with love, has nothing to do with healing, has to do with human splits and schizoid personalities and suffering people who project it onto other people. What love is about, and we innately want to love. Children are innate lovers, and they innately seek love and seek to be loved. And the healing thing for any human being in this universe is to love and be loved. And that's what I found in the 12-step program. And out of that, I began to come back to the scriptures. I began to see that indeed that's what they were saying. Indeed that was what was there. Unless you become as little children, I forgive you no matter what was the message. I forgive you. I forgive you. I forgive you. I accept you just like you are. Now, that is what heals people, at least as far as I'm concerned. And if we try to stand up here and pussyfoot around, I sound like Wallace, the spirituality of these issues, I just think that's missing the mark. That what it's about, listen to Einstein. A human being is part of a whole called by us a universe. See, it's systems. We're not just a family system. My body's a system. A state is a system. The United States is a system. A universe is a system. All of it's a system. We're all part of something else. We're always wholly a part and partly a whole. A human being is part of the whole called by us universe, a part limited in time and space. He experiences himself, his thoughts, and his feelings as something separate from the rest. A kind of optical delusion of his consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us. It restricts us to our personal decisions and to our affections for a few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of compassion to to embrace all living creatures and the whole nature in its beauty. This is Albert Einstein, the physicist. His great student and protege is David Bohm. And Bohm has written Wholeness and the Implicate Order. Great physicist arguing that we're all connected. And that when we hit this higher realm, when we get into this center, we find that we're just like that family was, that we're all connected and you can't separate anybody out from anybody else. That we are the world. We are the people. And that we're all connected to each other. It's only that sickness and that narrowed ego and that insecurity and that shame that creates division, separation, conflict, competitiveness that kills. It's those things that are killing us. And it's those things that we must address, even though there's no simple answer to it. There's no simple answer to it. As far as I'm concerned, out of my own commitment, there's a real clear way to go. And that's through prayer and meditation. Then the 12th step, in all the 12-step programs said, having had a spiritual awakening, we carried these principles to others. It's going out two by two. It's helping others. You know, if you go into the biblical material, if you're Judeo-Christian, always in the Bible, it's corporate. It doesn't say, David, you rotter, I'm going to really get you for messing around with Bathsheba. The Bible doesn't say that. It says, oh, Israel, my people. It's always a corporate act. There's a story in Mark where the crowd lowers a man down from the roof to Jesus. You see, it's like what you get is that all the people were, they had the trust, the expectant trust. They said, we're not going to let you die. We're going to take you and bring you to him. And you see, what we really need to understand is that we're going to need a lot of intervention in the days to come. We're going to need to intervene when families see that workaholic father or that alcoholic father or that worryaholic mother who's dysfunctioning the system. Then we're going to need to go and intervene and make an intervention and confront in a loving way. And you see, that terrifies us because we've been taught to be nice. We've been taught to mind our business. And none of us want to do that because we want to be lovable. One of the things that we're learning is that we have to do interventions. I want to read you some of the steps that like a group, myself and some others, just were working up interventions, working with some sports figures, teaching them drug interventions, because they sit there on teams which are families, knowing that one of their brother or fellow players is dying of cocaine addiction, and nobody does anything about it. Or you watch somebody in your family, a mother or a daughter, be dying of codependency. And remember, we said codependency is a primary illness, that you can die of it. You will die of it. That they'll either take your stomach out at a certain point, but you'll die of it ultimately. Because it's a primary illness. It has a progression, and it'll kill you. It's an addiction to people. It's an addiction to destructive relationships. It's an addiction to your children. It's an addiction to some kind of person or group. It begins with one person who's willing to reach out for help, and through that person, a group of meaningful people is gathered. Now, I've done this a lot. I've set these up a lot. And what we do with them is we call a group of people together and say, look, we know somebody who's very sick, and he's causing severe problems in his family. And I'm talking about someday we'll do this with workaholics. Someday we'll do this with rageaholics and violent fathers and families. Someday we'll be doing these interventions because we learned it from the alcoholic people. We learned it, and remember I'm saying that alcoholism is just the tip of the iceberg of a codependent, compulsive society, denying its sexuality, denying its anger, denying its feelings. Then the education process. We need to teach people about what you've been learning in this series, what compulsions are. We need the data collection of specific examples of abusive behavior. Daddy, you said you were going to take us on a vacation. We've all waited for that vacation. When it came time to the vacation on December the 9th, 1947, you wouldn't go. You had to work. Honey, you said we were going to spend time together. How many times have you said that? See, and you give them the data so you can help them get out of their own delusion and denial. This is an act of love, because you can't know what you don't know. You can't know what you don't know. Then the development of a goal and a specific treatment plan for the abuser. Whatever the addiction is, the lady who's the vacuum cleaner we need to intervene with. The commitment of a family treatment plan, a planned rehearsal of the intervention. The intervention is, look, here's what I saw you do. I love you. You are killing yourself. And we have a plan to help you. That's what the interventions are. If that had happened to me at 21, I don't know what I'd have done with my life differently, but it could have. It could have happened to me at 21. I was so sick at 21 in terms of alcoholism. I was so glad to get out of my alcoholism by going to the seminary. The confrontation and the intervention with meaningful persons, the counselor and the abuser. See, we've got to care about suffering people. And to a in a sense, any family that keeps the denial going is enabling that person to move on to death, including the workaholic, the alcoholic, the eating disorder people, all those forms of eating disorder that we talked about, all the emotional compulsivities that we talked about. Now, I want to say a few more things. Let me have the questions. Let me answer the questions, and then I'll finish up talking about some of the things that we've discovered about this higher life and higher consciousness. Do you think people develop harmful dependency on addiction on 12-step programs? Okay, remember what our definition of compulsivity is. It's a pathological relationship. What's pathological? Delusional and denial. That's what we mean by pathological. It's the delusional denial system. Pathological relationship to an event, an experience, or a thing, or a person, or a substance that has life-damaging consequences. Now, in the early days of going to 12-step programs, I was teaching at a high school. I wouldn't grade my papers. I'd go to meetings. In that sense, it was beginning to become life-damaging. That is, there was such a high of going to the meetings that, of course, the meetings can become addictive. And people can get addicted on anything. Remember, I said you can get addicted on carrots, carotene. Anything is an addictive substance, because what addiction is about, remember what addiction's about? Abandonment, neglect, abuse, and enmeshment. That's how you got set up in your families for addiction. That's what addiction is about. It's not about the substances. That's just the behavior modification. It's about the psychological conditions that initiated you into the addiction, which in the beginning, when you went into your denials, were salvific. The dissociated person who's being sexually abused is saving her life by being dissociated. So I hope you hear that. And I'm not saying those ego defenses were bad in the beginning, but 40 years later or 30 years later is when they're bad. I was and continue to be emotionally abused by my parents. How do I stop this abuse? Ignoring it does not help. Well, the important thing for me, to any kid that's listening to me, is to talk to somebody about this. Find somebody that you can talk to. A school counselor. Now, be careful, because some school counselors are carrying this same stuff that we're talking about. I've had it happen several times where we've discovered incest in a family. The woman goes home and tells her husband. He says, "You're imagining all that stuff." Now, why do you want to bring all that up and just cause a lot of consequences in our family? Let's just leave well enough alone. And this woman's been carrying this all her life. So the important thing is, don't keep the secrets. Don't keep the secret. Tell whoever you can tell. Go to the minister. Go to the rabbi. Go to the counselor until you get one to listen to you about the kind of emotional abuse that you're having. And, of course, for a greater reason, that goes for physical abuse, or for even greater reason, sexual abuse, and those severe forms of abuse that are life-damaging and soul-murdering. And they have no right to continue to go on. That's why we must do something about it. We're sorry about the parents' problems and their self-absorption and their projections, but we cannot allow this to go on. If you came from a family where you could not be angry or emotional, how can you be truthful 30 years later? Can we be okay fully functioning without confronting the family of source? That's a wonderful question. Now, first of all, How can you be emotional 30 years later? Yes, unequivocally, but it takes a lot of hard work to do it. At least if I'm any example. You see, I had so much repressed anger that I didn't even know when I was angry. People would say, aren't you angry about that? I'd say, no, I'm not angry about that. And then my anger would come out someplace else. It might come out to my wife, or it might come out to my children, or it might come out in a burst of rage somewhere. See, remember, if you don't hand it back, you pass it on. I don't know that I've said that enough. If you don't give it back to where you got it, you pass it on. And see, that's why we must confront it in its source. We're not blaming anybody, but you got to know what happened to you. If you don't know what happened to you, how can you do anything about it? So, now, can you be a fully functioning person without confronting the family of source? Absolutely, unequivocally. You don't have to go confront your mother or confront your father or confront the grandfather or whoever it was who abused you. There are several ways that that can be worked out. For example, there are many therapies. There's a therapy where they do it with chairs. You talk to your father in the chair, and then you become your father and talk back. And people don't realize the power of this kind of therapy. It's called Gestalt therapy, where you get into the feelings. The important thing is getting into the feelings. Remember what I said. It isn't the trauma that causes emotional illness. It's the repression of the trauma. It's the inability to tell anybody, to have any allies, to talk about it. And for a kid who's getting emotionally abused, go to PDAP or go to Alateen. You can just tell them you've got an emotional addict you're living with. They don't have to be an alcohol addict. They can be an emotional addict. They can be addicted to their sadness. Or they can be addicted to their rage or whatever. But that person needs help and needs to get out of that, because everybody's got a right to their life. You see, we're in an offender-protective society. I had a doctor call me not long ago when I had found severe abuse in a lady's history, saying, please don't use the word abuse. That's too harsh. You know, and say, here we are talking about what word we can use when she's the one that's been through it. And it has had, unbelievably destructive consequences in her life. I couldn't begin to tell you the destructive consequences in her life. So here, even at 70 years old, we can't let her say that she was sexually abused. You see the setup? And you see how the society keeps it going on because we stay in the denials and the delusions. Now, what I believe is, folks, is that if human beings were able to enter into this higher consciousness, to go to this God center within them, this Christ center, God center, whatever your belief system is, mine is that it's the Christ center, that if a person can go into that center and go into that higher consciousness, here's what the data now from the behavioral sciences is telling us, is that indeed when you're in that higher consciousness, you are in touch with all consciousness. That there is a way that we are truly in touch with all consciousness. So that when you turn it over into that higher consciousness, you have power available to you that a person cannot imagine or even believe until they've really experienced that power. Now, some of you probably prayed or heard, let go and let God, or turn it over, or let go of it. If you let it go, it'll come back. Well, I'm not talking about that from a sort of a spiritual, pushing a spiritual point of view. I'm talking about that from a psychological point of view, that the data is that as we go, we know there's this higher consciousness. We know it through dreams. We know it through biofeedback. We know it through telepathy. We know it through the work that's going on at Stanford Research Institute that the Russians are also doing, what's called the remote viewing ESP work, where we know that people can know things, that they're not limited by space and time, and that they do this the best when they're in this higher self, this higher consciousness. The work at Stanford Research by Gerald Puthoff and Russell Targ, The Silent Pulse by George Leonard, these books describe the work that's going on, where a woman in an electronically sealed room can know what somebody's seeing 2 hours later before they get there. And that's been corroborated with what I think is real sound kind of data. J.B. Ryan at Duke gave us work on telepathy. See, what's telepathy? That's two consciousnesses being connected. Clairvoyance, clairaudience. How many mamas? My mother used to know when I was sneaking around. Mamas have clairvoyance. They have clairaudience. They can know things that you just can't believe they can know. And lots of us haven't trusted that until now. And now we're beginning to get corroboration of it. You see, I said in the beginning program that the problem of our time is that we don't trust ourselves, that we make wrong choices because we have a wrong belief about ourselves. If I really can understand that I am the image of God, that there is a God center, there's a kingdom within, there's a still, quiet voice, that if I will be still and know, that I will get information that's not belief anymore, it's absolute, immediate, intuitive information about me. That still, quiet voice, be still and know that I am God. That's what the meditators are telling us. That's what the traditions of spirituality have been telling us, the perennial traditions of spirituality, that there is a place that you're not alone, that the kingdom is within. And that is a healing kingdom. It is the deepest self. It is your true self, that your sociocultural ego, which is limited by language and culture, is not where it's at. There is a deeper place within you. And this is what makes life worthwhile, ultimately, is to get to that place. That's what somebody has called homecoming. And I want to read you what they say about it. One never comes home until one prefers a gentle heart to mastery over other lives. One comes home when one learns how to bring a gift and how to receive one. When one is home, he gives love, makes comfort, hurts for justice. One is homeward bound when one is more tormented by the death of innocence and innocent children than by the frustration of ambition. One makes a home every time he allows a person to feel at home with their self. One is on the right road, not far away, close enough to run the last mile when he realizes that the greatest of all gifts to give another is home. And that the most surprising and wonderful gift to receive is homecoming. Now, to me, that's where it's at. That's what the family's about. We are the world. We are the people. If I can get to that deep self within me, that spiritual core, I can understand that this is the family. This is the human family. I can have this sense of oneness with all people and all things. I can rise above pettiness and division and fragmentation and alienation, because I can find that home. And somebody said this, I think it's Oscar Wilde, that this is the true joy of life, to live for this higher purpose recognized by yourself, to be this mighty place, to be a force of nature rather than a feverish little clod of grievances and ailments, claiming that the world is not devoting itself to making me happy. My life belongs to the whole universe, and the more I work and the harder I work, the more I live. Life is its own splendid justification. It's not a flickering candle like Shakespeare said. It's rather a burning torch. And I want to make my torch burn as bright as I can before I hand it on to my children and before I hand it on to future generations. And to me, that's what human life is about, is finding that home within ourselves, that deep place within ourselves, that profound sense of self that nobody can take away from you. And you see, once I love myself and I'm in that home, that's the only thing I'll never have to work at again, is being myself. You see, and the thing that the battle that you will always lose is the battle that you have with yourself.